I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. The third day of the Republican National Convention is underway in Cleveland, and WHYY senior reporter Dave Davies is on hand with the Pennsylvania delegation joining us now. Dave, what are we expecting this evening?
Well, it's day three, Dave, and before we get to this evening, I'll just note there was, as we just heard from NPR, there was a little more conflict on the streets today, and I heard from a couple of delegates that an attempted burning of the flag was stopped by some bikers for Trump, who these delegates described as big tattooed guys you wouldn't want to mess with. A few rests. Now, tonight, of course, we're going to have some big speakers, including some former rivals of Donald Trump. Ted Cruz is of particular interest, of course. He's a skilled speaker. He has not endorsed Trump. He probably wants to run for president in 2020. And, of course, he spent half the campaign being called Lion Ted by the party's nominee. So that's one I'm looking forward to.
So we'll also hear from the vice presidential nominee, Mike Pence.
Right. And, you know, I have to say, Dave, following the Pennsylvania delegation, that was a pick that was greeted pretty warmly by a lot of the delegates from Pennsylvania who might have some discomfort with Trump, you know, a flashy New Yorker who marries supermodels. This morning at the Daily Caucus of the Pennsylvania delegation, Congressman G.T. Thompson from Western Pennsylvania, who served two terms with Pence in the House, spoke to the delegation. Here's what he had to say about Pence.
Mike is a very accomplished member of the House of Representatives, governor, a friend, and maybe most importantly, a Bible study buddy of mine. When he says that he is a Christian, a conservative, and a Republican, and it's in that order, he means it.
Yeah, you don't hear Bible study buddy that often. You know, Dave, Thompson represents the largest congressional district east of the Mississippi River. It runs from Lake Erie all the way down to State College in central Pennsylvania. Pretty rural, with a lot of Christian conservatives, so Pence plays well in those parts of the state.
Dave, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie had his big moment at the convention podium last night, predictably going after Hillary Clinton, but perhaps not predictably prompting chance of lock her up. Did that surprise analysts?
It did. I think it surprised all of us. You know, it was stunning to observe that. And some veteran reporters I spoke to who've been to a lot more conventions than I have said they had never seen anything like that. You know, Franklin and Marshall analyst Terry Madonna, who we talked to a lot back home, is here at the convention. And he said it was unprecedented in his experience in 12 conventions. He said, you know, conventions are a time when you're going to throw some hard shots at your opponent. But this was different.
Normally, you disagree with somebody's policies. You suggest that they're not going to be a good chief executive, that they'll make bad decisions. But you often don't suggest that the outcome ought to lead to the imprisonment of your opponent. So the tenor of this is very sharp, and it's only likely to get worse, perhaps on both sides.
Yeah, so that, lock her up chant was troubling to a lot of people. Arizona Senator Jeff Flake, a Republican, publicly criticized it. You know, I asked several people here in the Pennsylvania delegation today whether they were comfortable with this or thought that it coarsened or degraded our political dialogue. The answer I got was pretty much no. I mean, that Hillary has earned what she's getting here. And, you know, I just mentioned those conservative areas in western Pennsylvania. In a lot of places, people simply just take it as fact that Obama ignores the rule of law, has savaged the Constitution, and Hillary Clinton, if elected, will do worse.
Did anyone express any qualms?
I had an interesting exchange with the Speaker of the State House, Mike Terzai, when I asked him about this and what he thought of the tone. He responded by talking about Christie's arguments about Hillary Clinton. And I said, okay, yeah, but you preside over a legislative body where people have to get along. Were you chanting, lock her up? And he immediately said, no, he would never do that. Civility is a very important part of public discourse.
WHYY senior reporter Dave Davies in Cleveland. And as authorities in Philadelphia prepare for next week's Democratic National Convention, one message has been made clear. The response to protesters will be far different than in 2000. That's when the city hosted the Republicans and police arrested more than 400 demonstrators. WHYY's Bobby Allen reports that the legacy of the RNC is on officials' minds as they brace for tens of thousands of demonstrators next week.
When asked recently whether Philadelphia police plan to outfit officers with riot gear during the DNC, here was Commissioner Richard Ross's response.
No, we don't.
You might see law enforcement from Homeland Security or SWAT team members wearing heavy equipment, but
we will not be outfitted in anything special for the DNC. I mean, it's going to be soft clothes. We're going to deal with this just as it's a peaceful event.
Peaceful is not how most remember the RNC in 2000, where tensions between protesters and police raged. In one of the most notorious episodes of the convention, undercover state troopers infiltrated a warehouse in West Philadelphia. Demonstrators there were making puppets and floats. Activists called the warehouse the Ministry of Puppet Ganda, but authorities suspected they were a communist-inspired group that could be dangerous. Specifically, police were worried about marchers using PVC pipes and chains to link arms and create human blockades. Here's then-Deputy Police Commissioner Sylvester Johnson talking about the people in the warehouse.
Their intentions was to stop down all traffic and block everything that's going on and stop the movement and shut down the entire city.
Jody Netzer helped rent the warehouse in 2000, and she said Johnson was way off.
We were making cardboard, art, puppetry. That's the purpose of this space.
Chris Hermes was on the ground in 2000 as a legal observer. He's also written a book about the national impact of the police tactics used during the convention. He says what really emboldened protesters in Philly at the time were the anti-globalization rallies happening around the country that resulted in hundreds and hundreds of arrests.
One in Seattle at the WTO meetings in 1999. And then a few months later, the IMF and World Bank meetings in April of 2000 in Washington, D.C.
During the RNC, around 97% of the charges from the 400 arrests were thrown out in court, including those that stem from the puppet warehouse. Back then, the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office charged organizers carrying cell phones with possession of an instrument of crime. The city ended up paying tens of thousands of dollars in settlements after more than a dozen protesters filed lawsuits alleging that police were overzealous. Ahead of the 2000 event, officials made bold comments. Former Mayor John Street said, "Those looking to make a spectacle are going to get a, quote, very ugly response." And this is how then Police Commissioner John Timoney described the protesters.
What we have here, it's become clear to me, are conspirators. There's nothing else to call them. People that sit around and conspire to come into city after city to cause mayhem, to commit violence against police officers and citizens.
16 years later, Police Commissioner Ross is striking a different tone.
We're not looking to make arrests. That is not our plan. Obviously, if the situation warrants it, then that's what we'll do, but only as a last resort.
Ahead of this convention, officials are doing it a little differently. City Council softened penalties for nuisance crimes like disorderly conduct and blocking a highway. It's now punishable with a $100 fine instead of arrest and jail time. Other aspects of the city's DNC planning have inspired less praise. For instance, the city has purchased $5 million of special insurance to cover payouts from any claims of police brutality.
They have insurance that basically allows them to be deliberately indifferent to the civil rights of individuals.
Larry Krasner is a Philadelphia criminal defense attorney who represented protesters in 2000. And you can bet he'll be keeping an eye on how things shake out this time around. He's not the only one. The ACLU's Mary Catherine Roper sued the city last month for free speech violations after the city tried to prevent rush hour marchers. After the suit, the marching restrictions were lifted.
I'm hoping there is no crackdown for anybody to ever report on. The city says it's committed to people's First Amendment rights. We just want to ensure that they live up to that.
Planners have designated a protest staging area in FDR Park, close to the convention's main stage at the Wells Fargo Center. But police say they won't arrest any protesters for demonstrating in other parts of the city, as long as they're peaceful and respect the periodic traffic closures. But Commissioner Ross says with any event as big and contentious as the DNC, there's going to be a, quote, level of anarchy that authorities will almost certainly have to contend with. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
Still ahead this evening, in addition to the Democratic National Convention, the nation's oldest LGBT civil rights summit, Equality Forum, starts Monday.
I believe that the Philadelphia Conference will be perceived as akin to the Seneca Falls for the LGBT civil rights movement.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY. Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. The Democratic National Convention gets underway Monday. That also marks the start of the Equality Forum Summit in Philadelphia. Let's get a preview with Malcolm Lazen, Executive Director of the Equality Forum. Malcolm, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
And thank you for the opportunity.
Equality Forum, the nation's oldest LGBT civil rights summit. What is on the agenda this year?
Well, so because of the convention, we're holding four major panels, a national politics panel, legal panel, elected officials panel, and future of the movement. Two truly nationally important LGBT historic marker dedications, and then our traditional awards ceremony. But it's really an opportunity, you know, at its base to really look at, you know, what are the issues that the LGBT community is asking of the Democratic and Republican parties and the political process.
Let's take up the legal challenges first. You were a federal prosecutor, chair of the Pennsylvania Crime Commission. Of course, we are now talking post the landmark Supreme Court case. What are the legal challenges ahead?
Well, I think the legal challenges ahead are really multiple. Transgender issues that we're seeing around, you know, bathrooms, and certainly pushback in terms of the so-called religious freedom initiatives. On an ad hoc basis, you know, those issues that impact particularly LGBTQ youth and elders.
As you cited historical markers, I understand you personally will be involved in championing one of the civil rights leaders in the 1960s.
Yes. Literally, there was a father and mother of the LGBT civil rights movement.
This is the mom.
And this is the mom, and her name is Barbara Giddings. She was from Philadelphia. I mean, her contributions are totally seminal and impactful and important. And so the historic marker will be the residence where she resided with her partner, Kay LaHusen, in the 1960s when she was doing that seminal work.
Was that around the same time as Stonewall in New York?
Well, actually, by the way, the answer to that is sort of a yes, in that Stonewall, of course, occurred in 1969. But what's really interesting about Stonewall, while there had been other riots involving the police in other places, including Philly and L.A. notably, nobody ended up remembering them. And so Barbara Giddings and Frank Kameny helped to organize a first anniversary march from Greenwich Village to Central Park. We now remember that as the first New York Pride Parade. So it's actually organizers, strategic organizers, of which Frank Kameny and Barbara Giddings were about the best, that literally are the reason that we now know Stonewall.
So in addition to Barbara Giddings, there's another historical marker to be unveiled.
Yes, and that's actually the Philadelphia Conference Historic Marker. It will be directly in front of the Arch Street Meeting House. I believe that the Philadelphia Conference will be perceived as akin to the Seneca Falls for the LGBT civil rights movement. And it's really because in the mid-1970s, there was a desire to emulate what then Negroes did in terms of the 1963 March on Washington. And one of the leaders of that was Harvey Milk. He gets assassinated in November of 1978. San Francisco activists galvanized and wanting to remember him call for a Philadelphia conference. And in February of 1978, over a weekend, 300 activists come together in Philadelphia and organize a national march on Washington for lesbian and gay rights. October 11th of 1979, 100,000 people participate in that demonstration. It's then followed by three even larger, up to million-plus people, marches in 1987, 93, and 2000. And so as you start to look back at the Philadelphia Conference, you realize it's the first time that gays now get together nationally and organize something that is of monumental movement import.
Malcolm, fast forwarding to 2016, do you share the assessment of many that Philadelphia is one of the most gay-friendly municipalities in the country?
Quite frankly, I think there are a lot of now gay-friendly, but I think what we're doing with these historic markers is identifying Philadelphia as the birthplace of the LGBT civil rights movement. You know, it joins two other historic markers, which are the Gay Pioneers Annual Reminders Marker directly across from Independence Hall, and the Giovanni's Room, which is, you know, the oldest LGBT bookstore.
Malcolm Lazen, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
And thank you, Dave.
Malcolm Lazen is executive director of the Equality Forum. It gets underway Monday, running concurrent with the Democratic National Convention. Delegates to the presidential nominating conventions tend to be political insiders. This year, some who don't typically appear on the convention floor are latching onto the process to try to be heard. WHYY's Laura Benchoff reports on the 2nd Pennsylvania Congressional District. It's sending the most delegates to the Democratic National Convention.
Let's just get this out of the way. You might not know or care who your delegates are, even if you're politically involved, like Bill Ewing.
I read the list at one point. It's screwy. Nobody knows who their delegates are.
Ewing has lived in Philadelphia's Mount Airy neighborhood for 45 years and took a break from phone banking for Hillary Clinton's campaign to explain his view of the delegates' role in the convention.
They don't have that much to do, really. They're going to vote for the people we voted for, so.
But some people are drawn to the process in this unusual election year. They're delegates and convention volunteers who don't see the convention as a passive political pageant where you already know who gets the crown, but instead as a chance to influence a national conversation. Clinton may have sewn up the Democratic presidential nomination, but 21-year-old University of Pennsylvania student and Bernie Sanders delegate Yasmin Kaboud is still optimistic.
We are still going to the convention as Bernie delegates, voting for Bernie. We are still fighting for key platform ideas. So at the convention itself, we will continue to vote for and support any policy that Bernie backs.
She says not even his supporters expect Sanders to win the nomination, but she and many other delegates plan to stay politically active anyway.
Because he is so progressive, especially with issues that surround young voters, so debt-free college, minimum wage, things like this. And that's a huge pool of people that he's been able to mobilize.
Sanders has mobilized young people across the country. Closer to home, there's another pocket of voters seeking representation in the 2nd District, suburbanites. Pennsylvania's 2nd Congressional District covers the western half of Philadelphia, and as of 2010, it also contains Lower Marion Township, which is strongly Democratic. Thanks to redistricting, Pennsylvania's 2nd is the most solidly Democratic congressional district in the country outside of the Bronx. It also means suburban Democrats in the 2nd are outnumbered 9-1 by Philadelphia Democrats.
You know, when you are kind of just a sliver of things, you know, you are a little bit less likely to want to be involved and do something.
Bill Madway is a member of the Lower Marion Democratic Committee. He says this year's Democratic National Convention gave him and other mainline Democrats a chance to have a bigger say. They did a lot of research into the delegate selection process and spent primary day outside Lower Marion polling places, telling people to vote for local delegates.
It was just hours at the polls trying to explain it, and it's a hard concept to explain to people because, you know, we were telling them to vote for delegates who didn't necessarily represent their candidate. Why? Why would I want to do that?
In the end, Lower Marion is sending 2 delegates to Philadelphia for the convention, a disproportionately large showing for such a small slice of the district.
As a result of that, now I feel, you know, much more optimistic. I'm volunteering for all sorts of things at the convention.
Madway himself isn't a delegate, but because he feels represented, he's joining 18,000 other convention volunteers to help the process run smoothly. That leaves one more category of people in the 2nd District who feel outnumbered: Republicans. That party's nominating rules mean that each district sends 3 unbound delegates to Cleveland, regardless of how few or how many GOP voters they represent. Aaron Cohen, a Republican living in Philadelphia, ran as a delegate committed to picking a candidate the entire party, not just moderate urban Republicans, could get behind.
Coming from one of the most Democratic congressional districts in America, saying that you would vote the way the district went wasn't necessarily the smartest move for picking a candidate who could carry the Commonwealth.
Republican primary voters in the 2nd picked John Kasich, who didn't perform well pretty much anywhere else in the state. As for the Republican Party's presumptive nominee, Donald Trump, Cohen doesn't flat out endorse him, but says the alternative is to rally around no one.
Look, I think that right now he has presented a very strong message that is resonating with quite a few voters.
Going to the convention means even if the 2nd District will never elect a Republican congressman, Cohen can at least try to help his party pick a Republican president that could win. Laura Benchoff, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov and Kimberly Haas. Next week, the DNC is not going to be the only gathering in town that'll be thinking about the presidency. School Kids Aplenty will convene on the Art Museum steps to write on the topic, If I Were President. We'll meet the organizer of the event on tomorrow's show. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.